Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome Kathleen McFall and Clark Hayes, authors of the new novel Kitchen Heat, a Restaurantland Romance. Kathleen and Clark are writing partners and a couple in real life, going on 26 years of marriage. Their previous books include four novels in the Cowboy and Vampire collection, the Bonnie and Clyde trilogy, which includes the novels Resurrection Road, Damnation, and Radioactive, and the Halo trilogy, Gates of Mars, Scorched Earth, and Mars Adrift. Kitchen Heat is their 11th book, all but the first published by their own imprint, Pumpjack Press. The books share a common recipe. Genre fiction, such as westerns, horror, spy novels, and science fiction, seasoned with lessons in U.S. history, a concern for progressive issues and social justice, and a healthy dose of humor. All guaranteed, as they say, to entertain and enlighten, which is a perfect dish for my own peculiar tastes. Please join us for our conversation with Kathleen and Clark, which is already in progress. Kathleen and Clark, thanks for joining us in the KBOO studios.
We're delighted to be here.
Thanks, Ken. Really happy to be here.
Well, Kathleen, let me start with you. Your previous books cover genre fiction such as westerns, horror with the vampire, alt history, spy novels with Bonnie and Clyde, science fiction with the Halo trilogy, and Kitchen Heat is a romance, a romantic comedy or rom-com in movie terms. What's the appeal of writing genre fiction for you?
Well, we enjoy experimentation. I mean, so we don't like to limit ourselves to one type of book or one expectation. And so through the years, we've, as you've noted, all of those different genres we've written in them. And we moved into romance this time just as to try something new. And because we like the joy aspect of it. Romance is very popular right now, and there's a lot of different reasons why people think that's so. In part, we think it may have something to do with the pandemic and the state of the world, so to speak. And readers come to romance, and there's so many readers there right now with an expectation and a bargain, really, with the authors or author that they will come away from it feeling optimistic. And that appealed to us at this time in our life. And we also, even though we do write in a lot of different genres, there's a common element in all of them, and that is there's a love story in every single book that we've ever written. And it's the setting is different, the outcomes are different, but there is a exploration of love, the joys, the complications, and all of those things. And I think in the end, that's probably the thing we most like writing about.
Yeah, one of Oregon's greatest writers, Ursula Le Guin,
yes,
was often labeled a genre writer of science fiction in her case, which she accepted and found it, and I quote, a very useful descriptive tool, but she also said it's also a pernicious instrument of prejudice. In other words, critics often use the term genre to disparage a book. If it's sci-fi, western, or romance, for example, it can't be the literature, not with a capital L. Has that been a concern for you?
I would say that was definitely a concern. Not a concern, but we were aware of it going into it. We certainly saw some feedback from some of our beta readers saying, wow, you're really moving into romance? That seems like quite a shift for you. But as Kathleen sort of mentioned, there's a lot of readers in romance right now, and for a lot of good reasons. And we wanted to sort of flex our writing muscles a little bit and try to engage in that community. It's been very fun and very successful, I'd say, so far.
That was actually in the title of your very first book, though, right? Was it A Most Unusual Romance?
Yes, exactly.
Cowboy and Vampire.
It is the first book we wrote, a romance of sort, a cowboy and vampire romance.
This was a nice symmetry there.
There is.
Now, Clark, the setting for Kitchen Heat is a fictional restaurant in Portland called the Rose and Thorn. That's based on an actual restaurant, Old Wives Tales, well known by longtime locals. It's no longer around, but it was located here on East Burnside, so not far from where we're sitting right now at KBOO, I think about five blocks. It was opened for 34 years from 1980, closed in 2014, And you both worked there in the 1990s. Clark, you as a waiter, and Kathleen, you as a waitress. Well, oh, I mean, you as a cook.
I was a cook, right.
Yeah, cooking up that Hungarian mushroom soup.
Cooking up the Hungarian mushroom soup.
So just like in this book itself, Kitchen Heat, that was also the start of your relationship, right?
It was. Old Wives' Tales was definitely the inspiration for The Rose and Thorn. There are some differences, of course. And similarly, the way we met at The Rose and Thorn was the inspiration for the story that's told, the love story that's told in Kitchen Heat. There are many things that are similar. There are also many things that are different. But we did meet there. I was a waitress. I was also a single mom at the time, similar to the character in the book.
Cassie.
Yeah. I want to just do a shout out to the restaurant itself, how wonderfully welcoming it was to me at the time. It was really hard to be a single mom, a working single mom in that era. And they were really great in the way they were really great with Cassie. And I will always be grateful for that. And always be grateful that the first day I was there, I met Clark/Clay.
And Clay is the head chef.
He's the head chef there.
In the fictional restaurant in the book. And he looks somewhat like Brad Pitt, a lot like Clark, I think.
Yes, that's exactly right.
He does.
That's where the reality of the book stops. The handsome head chef, that the rest of it's fictional.
I should mention to our listeners that the book is written in the form of a screenplay. Not necessarily, but there's a kind of sets the scene. And then the story itself becomes a screenplay. So we're kind of reading the story. It's like a movie within a movie in several ways. And it follows, as the main character, Cassie, says in here, because she's the one writing the screenplay, a three-act structure, which is well known in movie screenwriting. Girl meets boy, girl loses boy, girl gets boy back. And that reflects your own experience. So you met at Old Wives' Tales, but there was a breakup and then a reconciliation, which has lasted over 25 plus one.
As a quick aside, we were planning our 25th wedding anniversary getaway this year, and our daughter said, you're silly. That was last year.
So we missed our own 25th wedding anniversary.
So we've actually been together, married 26 years.
Oh, you can't celebrate that, though.
That's... Well, 25 plus one. That's what we're calling it now.
So what was the, what led to the breakup there? Was that while you were both working at the restaurant?
Well, so it was, and...
I'll take over on this one.
I was going to say, how far do we go on this?
Let's spill some tea, as they say. So we met at the Old Wives' Tales. We were both married to different people at the time. Nothing untoward happened, but we definitely felt sparks, and we definitely felt a connection. We sort of went on our separate ways about a year later, I would say. I ended up in Central Oregon. When our paths crossed again, we realized that there was really just a significant connection there, and we wanted to explore it. We started exploring it. Then I'd say we got in a little bit of a weird sort of dysfunctional, fiery, passionate phase, and we broke up. And we broke up for about 2 years?
Just about that, yes.
And at the end of 2 years, we realized that we actually really wanted to make it work. So we decided to try again, be very intentional this time, and try to tame some of that, what I would call very dysfunctional but passionate creative energy.
And you were geographically separated,
we were
right?
Still separate. I was in Central Oregon. Kathleen was in Portland. So we decided to write a book together and to see if we could make that work together, we figured we'd have what it would take for the long haul. So this was... a while back, there were no computers or email wasn't really a thing. So we were literally handwriting chapters, mailing them back and forth. And that is how The Cowboy and the Vampire, A Very Unusual Romance, came to be. And that is how our relationship was salvaged and has now lasted 25 plus 1 years.
Wouldn't that be great if when you apply for your marriage certificate, they make you write a novel together?
That would be.
Yeah, we're going to test the relationship. We don't want a divorce here.
Or some sort of creative endeavor, yes.
Right. But a collaboration. What a great way to do it. I want to get back to the fictional Rose and Thorn. So Old Wives' Tale was a pioneer here, serving healthy food. So starting in 1980, a favorite of Portland vegetarians, along with fans of the restaurant's famous Hungarian mushroom soup, which you must have cooked up, Clark, and you must have served Kathleen by the cauldron, Phil.
Certainly.
I know I had it there. And from comments by the Rosenthorne staff in the book, it seems you might have a love-hate relationship with the signature dish.
I'll take the lead on that just because I made so much of it.
You earned it.
So I probably in my time there, which I guess was about 3 years, 3 or 4 years, maybe five, I probably made 500 gallons of Hungarian mushroom soup. It was one of their signature soups. It was on the old wife sales had just this amazing salad bar with an all-you-can-eat salad bar with about four soups, always had Hungarian mushroom soup. And it required so much butter, so much sour cream, so much whole milk. It was basically like a pasta sauce, but it was delicious. And yeah.
But not the most healthy.
It might have not been the most for, you know, calorie conscious diners. It may not have been the perfect dish, but I mean, yeah, people would put it on noodles back in the kitchen. I mean, they would just like blop some onto pasta because it was just so delicious.
Now, the Rosenthorne in the book is staffed by a diverse group, which I assume you also experienced when you were working at Old Wives' Tale. And diverse, I mean by not just in terms of personality, but gender, race, sexual orientation. The restaurant's owner in the book is named Molly, and the Old Wives' Tale owner was Holly.
Correct.
So one letter change, Holly Hart, who referred to herself as the old wife. Are the characters based on people you work with, like Molly and Holly, or maybe a composite,
so,
or roughly, loosely based?
I think that I'd say almost all of the characters, there's probably a few exceptions, are based on people. Let me be careful with that. They're inspired by people that work there because there's some attributes that we took great liberties with, for example, for either the purposes of enhancing the banter in the kitchen or making... for a more dramatic effect. But yes, they are mostly based on people that we knew and really cared for. It was just a very warm and supportive place. And Molly was terrific as an owner and as a manager. Yeah, I think that that's the case.
And I think the thing that's so striking about the restaurant that drove us to want to set a book there is that it was so ahead of its time in just being a welcoming community for everyone. It was a safe place for women who were suffering from, you know, domestic violence issues, for the LGBTQ community. You could count on never being turned away from the Old Wives' Tales if you needed help.
Yeah, you actually have I have a quote here from the book. One of the servers at the Rosenthorne, so the fictional restaurant in the book, describes it as, "This place is super well known in Portland. It's a safe place for gays and lesbians and battered women, other victims of mostly male violence. Anyone can hang out here if they need a ride or help or whatever," that what you were saying, Clark. And it's real pro-woman. Like, the owner is a single mom and she tries to hire single moms, Kathleen,
yes,
like you were, whenever she can. And then the main character, so the Kathleen, your counterpart in the book, Cassie, says, "The Rosenthorne has been so much more than a job for me. It's more than a restaurant. It's a safe place for all the misfits out there, like me, the misfits who can't seem to find their own way." So what a special place. I mean, you don't find too many work environments
yeah.
like that.
We used to go back after we both left. Clark was there for about 5 years. I was only there for about a year and a half. So we had a overlap toward the end of Clark's tenure. But still, years later, we would go back every year on our anniversary, if we ever remembered it. and just go in and have a meal. And it's over those 10 years or so, it stayed the same. And it was just a remarkably consistent presence in Portland. You know, and I like to think that in many ways it kind of inspired aspects of the way that Portland itself grew. You know, it has a vibe that's very similar to the vibe that KBOO has, a real sense of community and caring about the world in which you exist and operate.
Yeah, I hope we're not vestigial at this point. it's not quite the same in Portland now.
But, no, it's
but
not.
Certainly that's.
And, you know, that's a point that maybe I'll bring up here as well, that in addition to setting it there because we worked there and we're familiar with the restaurant, the whole book in itself is, in being set in the 90s, is kind of just our love letter to Portland, too. You know, we really love Portland very much. And
yeah, a lot of Portland references in there.
Yes.
Powell's, the Alibi Tiki Room?
The Tiki, yes. And, you know, as one of our reviewers said, it harkens back to a Portland that maybe doesn't exist anymore because Portland's going through a relatively difficult time right now. And it was really heartening for us personally, and we hope for our readers too, to remember that Portland, or if you weren't here, to be reminded of that Portland. And to be reminded that, you know, we'll get through these tough times now and come to a better time too, that probably in some part has its seeds in places like Old Wives' Tales and KBOO, the community-centeredness of it.
I want to talk about the setting, too. So, again, we know it's a fictional restaurant, the Rose and Thorn, based on Old Wives' Tale. But the restaurant itself, come to think of it, a radio station wouldn't be a bad idea either, but I think it's been done. WKRP in Cincinnati and a few other things like that. But, again, Cassie, so your counterpart, Kathleen, in the book, says restaurants are like that. Honestly, not just sex, though. It's love and romance, too. It's partly tied up with the long hours, the nutty pace, the drinking after shifts to bring down the adrenaline, not to mention the high turnover, which means there's almost always someone new being added to the already steamy mix. On top of that, there's the sensual, intimate nature of cooking and serving food, of nurturing people. Put all that together, repeat it day after day, and it's a romantic pressure cooker. I think I heard, actually, Kathleen, you saying that this is going to be a series. So
yes.
Kitchen Heat is just the first book in the series. And they'll all be set in a restaurant, maybe the Rose and Thorn.
Yes, they will all be set in the Rose and Thorn with other places that the characters go to. And in fact, we're about two-thirds of the way through with the second book. And it is takes the story of two characters that were introduced in Kitchen Heat, Roz and Hudson, which you may remember. But obviously our listeners won't know yet unless they've read the book.
Roz was one of the waitresses, and Hudson was a cook who had kind of a checkered past. He was in the Eastern Oregon Correctional Facility.
Mm-hmm. That's where he learned how to cook. So yes, there will be, at this point, we see it kind of as an unlimited series in terms of the number of books, and will probably go on as long as our interest is maintained and readers are engaged.
I'm ready for more.
Okay.
I did mention the word steamy, and that comes up a lot when you're writing and talking about the book. You know, this romantic pressure cooker and the romance genre, there has to be several sex scenes. And there are in the book, some of them described in great detail. The FCC is listening, so I won't go into specifics. But as Cassie finds while she's working on her screenplay, quote, turns out sex scenes were tough to write. And I know that there's even an annual Bad Sex in Fiction Award, which I looked it up. It's honoring, if that's the right word, the year's most outstandingly awful scene of sexual description in otherwise good novel. That must have been a challenge for you to, as it is for any writer, writing a realistic sex scene that's not, you know, kind of silly.
It certainly is challenging, and I hope we are not nominated for that award. I'll just say that right now. But yeah.
I think John Updike must have retired. That's my guess.
It is a challenge. It's a challenge, right? Because it's a personal experience. You're trying to write about someone's internal personal experience, shared personal experience. So it's expected in romance novels, so we wanted to honor that, certainly. And, you know, so we did what any writer of worth their salt does. We researched it a lot, endlessly, and then, you know, wrote many, many drafts and script, edits and...
Stopping every now and then to jot notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Kept a notebook by the... Well, I think it turned out well. I hope readers respond to it for what we're aiming for, which is just really the, you know, the passionate, emotional coming together of these characters. So,
and I'll add to that, writing in that way about sex is challenging because there's a fine line that you have to walk because some of the vocabulary about sex can be very crass and kind of offensive.
Right.
Especially in the way body parts might be named. But then those are really familiar to people, so then you end up having to kind of make up other names that might describe where that thing is in someone's, on someone's body. But, you know, you also can run the risk of getting super trite really quickly and just... I think we made it work. So
it worked for me.
It's not too much, but it's not too, frankly, childish.
Well, also, it's talked about, which I'm sure is talked about in every kitchen in restaurants.
Oh, right, for sure.
And beyond every kitchen in every restaurant in the country. Now, on the Pump Jack Press website, you describe your books as, quote, high-octane, award-winning fiction with a social justice edge. And you write about issues pertaining to social justice in your books, in their historical context, but also how they still persist today. And to mention a few, labor unions come up, the great disparity in wealth between the haves and the have-nots in our country and the whole world, unfortunately. Climate change and the environment, that played a big part of the Halo trilogy. Now, in Kitchen Heat, you reference Oregon's sundown laws and the Tuskegee experiment. And this is all in the context of telling a gripping story. How do you integrate those history lessons, that social justice edge, into the book without slowing the narrative or appearing maybe preachy to the reader?
Well, that's a good question. And it's a challenge, too, just like writing the scenes we were previously describing. We want to use our voice and our platform to draw attention to things that matter to us, but we don't want to do it in a way that's off-putting to people. We also don't want to avoid them because we're afraid it will be off-putting to future readers. So it's a fine line to sort of work through that, but that's why we're in the writing business together. We want to tell engaging stories, and we want to inspire people to be thoughtful and, take a deeper look at the world around them and think about people who might need a hand up or a barrier pulled down for them to move forward.
No, it's interesting. I looked up both of those. The sundown laws I had some acquaintance with. Tuskegee experiment I had heard about but didn't really know much about. And it was kind of a way to just tell the reader enough. And if they're interested, they can go and research it on their own.
That was exactly the goal, and that's, I think, part of what we try and do is to bring these topics up, but not necessarily belabor them, so that people who read it are engaged and say, well, let me think about how I can find out more information on that. And part of, I think, that's one of the great things about working in the genre world is that there are certain constructs of each genre. For example, yes. Science fiction has certain expectations about it. Romance has certain expectations about how it will end, for example.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because Ursula Le Guin also talked about that. Again, she didn't mind being, pigeonholed, again, is the wrong word, but described as a science fiction writer, because she felt the same way. But she was very much against writers who would just attempt to write science fiction without studying the genre. And she said that there are certain expectations in there, certain things that are already understood that you don't have to milk, you don't have to beat a dead horse over, and then certain things that you have to follow to write genre fiction. And like Le Guin herself, you're able to kind of take off from that as long as you knew the rules first.
Exactly. So I think that's what we try to do, is that we, by understanding that structure, that narrative structure, it allows us to create and place characters in them that have the concerns that we're concerned about. That, for example, one of the cooks in the kitchen is the one that brings up the sundown laws to an otherwise mostly...
That's Luron,
to an otherwise mostly white kitchen at the time. And none of those people know what they are. And so it allows for a conversation. Yeah, so it's creating the characters that exist recognizably within those genres.
And to Kathleen's point, I think, and to your point as well, the great thing about genre fiction is you're able to leverage some of those expectations to create tension. So in romance, you don't necessarily expect to be hearing about sundown laws or Tuskegee experiments. But by sort of working them into the narrative's flow, it creates this tension that causes people, we hope, to think a little more deeply about them. Because they're everywhere. It's all around us. And, we should be doing our part to learn more about it.
It will be even more prevalent in the next book that we're working on. It takes place in the late 1990s and captures some of the fervency in Portland and around the area at the time related to eco-activism. So several of the characters in the restaurant who are working as cooks and or waiters and waitresses are also on their own participating in direct action. And so that will definitely be a little fiery.
And then will there be a third book in the series too?
Though we haven't mapped that one out yet, have we?
We haven't mapped it out, but we've introduced a character that we think will be compelling for the third book.
And what are some of the advantages for you as writers to do a multi-volume series rather than, say, a standalone title?
Well, we get more familiar. The first book in any series is, of course, the most challenging because you're creating the world in which your characters will exist. And once that world has been created, then the second, third, and fourth or fifth, I think the longest series we've done is the fourth, The Cowboy and Vampire, four books. You can have a lot more fun in terms of that part has been defined, and so then you have more fun with the characters and the plot and where you take them and what they do and what they say to each other. And also, it allows us to write a lot faster.
Because you've already got certain things settled.
Exactly.
You know the setting, mm-hmm. you know the time, and you've done your research there.
Exactly.
Absolutely. And, you know, setting the book in the 90s is, even though, you know, we lived through it, requires research, right? You have to sort of remember, like, okay, when did computers, when were we using computers?
Right, email, cell phones.
Right. What song was important in those days?
And, yeah, things we take for granted.
Right.
It wasn't that long ago.
It wasn't that long ago, but it's something that, you know, we're getting a lot of readers are responding to, and we're pretty proud of. You know, we're capturing this time before cell phones, and so many people don't understand what that is right now.
Yeah, I've always, when I watch a movie, an old movie now, I always think that plot would not work if there were cell phones.
Exactly.
Certainly the character in distress kind of thing. You know, pick up your cell phone, call the police.
Just call.
You know, yeah. But lot of Hitchcock movies would have been totally ruined by the internet and cell phones.
And just sort of, you know, back to the whole restaurant vibe. Now, when you have a few moments of spare time, no matter where you are, a restaurant or any other job or anywhere, you tend to pick up your phone. In those days, there was no phone to pick up. So you've sort of, if you wanted to pass the time, you either engaged in pointless banter with your workmates or found a new romance to get involved with because there was no phone distracting your attention. That was what you did.
I kind of miss pointless banter. But that's true everywhere.
Me too.
The cell phone. Now, Kitchen Heat marks the 11th book that you've written together, which I think means you've passed the relationship test by now. How do you collaborate the books, and has the process, which you've compared, Clark, to wrestling an alligator with your hands tied during a tornado? You mentioned that in my last interview with you guys.
Great memory.
Indie Publishers. Changed in the 25 years since your first book, that collaboration process. So you're not always wrestling that alligator, and maybe it's a different alligator each time.
I think that it hasn't changed that much.
Still an alligator.
It's still an alligator. I don't think, it hasn't changed that much. We still go through the process that Clark mentioned earlier about how we, at the very beginning, exchange chapters by mail. We still each take a chapter, and we know where the chapter will end.
And that's something you've decided as a pair.
Yes. So in the beginning, we outline a book, a new novel. The key point is where each chapter ends so that the other person who's going to take the next chapter can write that in a seamless manner.
And without reading the...
You don't even necessarily have to receive... Ah. So that way we don't have to wait for each chapter to be finished and read. So we can each take those chapters. And then we do go back and read them, of course, in that first draft process.
For continuity and all that.
But then the real first continuity and compilation of those different voices comes with the full edit of the first edit of the first draft. And that process has served us well, really, for all 11 books. There are certain things that we've figured out. We still argue about really minor things that, I mean, it sounds ridiculous.
But M-dashes are not minor.
Clark uses them to excess, I believe. He thinks I'm not
enough. You're not on Team M-dash.
But these are really minor things, and those are the kind of things that we've sorted out through the years that don't make really much of a difference anymore. And then, of course, we have people who are professionally, when we get to that point, professionally copy editing and polishing the books for us, and that those people then make some of those decisions outside of our process.
Yeah, and to add to that, I would say that, and also we're getting better at that. So, you know, this is our, as you mentioned, our 11th book together. We're getting better at sort of moving our voices toward a middle ground between the two of us, so there's not as much effort to... in that first edit to try to make the voices sound closer. We're better about the outlines we do. We're more detailed about that. We're getting better about thinking, okay, we need a plot twist here, or, here's something that this character might do that we should think about weaving into the rest of the story. And, you know, we're both fast writers. So we're able to, when we are able to sit down, we're able to churn out a lot of words each day. Between the two of us, we're one great writer.
Now, despite the alligators, the tornado and all that, when we talked before, Clark, you told me that writing together is probably the second most intimate thing a couple can do. And out of decorum, I didn't ask the question at the time, but always wondered, what's third?
Ooh, what's third? That's a good question.
A little misdirection.
Yeah, misdirection. I really love that. Let's see. I don't know. Most intimate thing.
Maybe that's okay. I just wanted to kind of.
That was a really good curveball. I'm gonna say
Koufax style.
Talking about books on your walk.
Oh wow.
Which
I noticed
do.
That you live near Forest Park,
right.
And you often walk together and then kind of talk over some plot
points. Well, we do. Surprisingly, we have really different reading tastes. Clark is unexpectedly mostly a nonfiction reader, or I'm a quite avid fiction reader of all kinds. And so we have a tendency to literally, since he will never read the books I'm reading and I'll never read the books he's reading, we share the plots in quite a lot of detail when we walk.
I am.
Well, you compliment each other.
I consider myself the luckiest man in the world for so many reasons, but one of those is because Kathleen is able to explain to me, with a writer's mind, the plot of all of these incredible books that she's read. And so, to me, it's like walking with my own podcast, my own fiction podcast. It's amazing.
Well, you should record those walks.
You
maybe.
Should.
Yeah, why not?
I mean, during the pandemic, this is a crazy story, but I just fell into it, but I read every single Ann Tyler book. Do you know who
oh,
she
yeah.
is?
Oh, yeah. She, Baltimore.
Baltimore, yeah. So I read every one of them. Not in order, but I just read them all as I could get them out of the library. And I then told every single plot to Clark as we walked. For that year, that's what we did. We walked and we talked about those books.
I got breathing lessons during the pandemic.
Yes.
Which is the title of
one of the books.
Ann Tyler book. Now, you not only write together, but you run your own independent publishing company, Pump Jack Press. And we did an interview a few years ago, so I think pre-COVID. No, actually, it was just the beginning of COVID.
It was.
We did it over Zoom, along with fellow indie publishers Dan Armstrong of Mud City Press and Bobby Eversman of Deep Overstock. And I know your first book was published by, not an indie press, but a traditional press, Llewellyn. Why did you start your own?
Well, there are a couple of different reasons, but I think mostly it had to do with wanting to have a little more creative control over the work that was being created. I said created twice there, but so...
We need that editor, huh?
Yeah.
Well, we'll just put an M-dash between
okay.
them.
Okay. but that, it was sort of, it was at the moment when indie publishing, when the platform, the print on demand was coming into being. And so the tools, the technology was evolving at the same pace as our desire to have more control over what we were doing and to not have the sometimes 3 or 4 year wait that can come when you work with a traditional publisher. We're not adverse to traditional publishing. We don't have any problem or cynicism about that process. But once we went through it for the first time, we decided that we wanted to try another path. We're interested now that we have 11 books under our belt. We continue to support other authors who are trying to go this indie route as well. We have opened up our press to other authors as well. We have two, maybe three others that have published now through Pump Jack Press. And it's a great community. It's a really vibrant, great community. I think, honestly, we're sort of on the cutting edge of that. And now you see partnerships beginning to develop between traditional publishers and indie publishing. New ways that take certain aspects of an independently published book that's done well with readers, and then a traditional publisher will swoop in with their distribution arms and then begin to distribute it to areas and venues that it's pretty challenging to get to as a independent author. So I think that covers it. Do you have anything else to add?
Well, I mean, to your point, it's difficult for indie publishers to see their books in an airport bookstore, for example. Because what it takes to have the hard copies distributed around the country in a meaningful way is financially prohibitive, let's say. So that cooperative model is very exciting, especially for authors. But
so the publisher would have to pay an airport bookstore to stock their books, or
well, it's the right of returns is the issue that trips up so many smaller presses, because many of the larger distribution networks, even if you can get in them, they require you to take the return on the book if they don't sell it. So a small press like us, in a just sort of a perfect storm scenario, we could have our book accepted, say, in airport bookstores or some large chain, and they would order 5,000 copies. And then if only 4,900 of them, or I mean, if only 100 of them sold, we would be responsible for reclaiming the 4,900 copies.
And paying the bookstore back.
Yeah,
and so, all the costs associated with the printing.
And all the costs, so we'd have to get them back and pay it to, for, and so it's just, it doesn't, it never pencils out. But the cooperative model is changing that. So we're excited. We're excited to see that.
And also e-books, digital
e-books
makes it much easier now. You don't need to get a print book in a store necessarily.
No. Certainly.
Our books are all available in stores, all the Pump Jack Press books. It's up to the store whether or not they choose to take it, to stock it, based on whether or not they are able to assume the risk associated with, because they can't return it to us. So if they order it from Ingram, our distributor, then that bookstore has to keep it on their shelves forever. For traditional publishers, yeah, of course, which will be a day.
But, right.
traditional publishers take that, they do larger print runs, of course, and then distribute to retail stores such as airports or wherever, and PALs included. And if they don't sell those books, those retailers don't sell those books, they then can return them to the publisher. The publishers have deep pockets. I mean, these are huge corporations where they can assume
and manage that cost. They merge and they become even bigger. And
so that's just the cost of doing business for them. For a small press or an indie publisher, and probably even many university publishers, that's a cost that's a very difficult thing to absorb, and you have to really manage it very carefully. But for example, we were thrilled to see Gates of Mars in the whole Halo trilogy on PAL's shelves recently.
Wow.
Yeah.
Was that in the sci-fi section?
Yes, it was great.
And in the local library.
Yes, the library stocks them also. Yeah, it's we're slowly making headway.
But it's challenging. And there's so much you have to learn to publish independently. That's why we're interested in sort of sharing that knowledge, however that works out, with other authors, because there's a very steep learning curve of all the little pieces that you have to put together to make it work.
And to do it right.
And to do it right. And it's daunting. And there's lots of people on the fringes of the industry who are willing to take your money in exchange for what they say will be, you know, marketing success or sales success or all of those things. And that's not necessarily always true. So, we've made some mistakes. We've learned along the way. And, we're happy to share our knowledge and our platform with other writers.
Now, another big difference between, say, an indie publisher and traditional, the traditional usually does the marketing and promotion, or at least they used to.
Yeah.
And when we talked before for the Indie Press Roundtable, you mentioned it can be somewhat of a burden, not just you, but also Bobby from Deep Overstock and Dan from Mud City Press. That's something that you do now. Again, the technology's there with social media to make it easier. But that also comes with the problem of, since it is easier, there's so much more content out there with more coming every day, books, movies, TV shows, podcasts. So how do you get the word out and kind of have your work stand out from millions and millions of other books?
Everything.
I know, Clark, you're on Threads now, which is kind of a Twitter competitor.
I am on Threads.
Formerly known as Twitter, I guess.
That's right. And I'm finding that community very supportive and engaging, and I've seen our numbers go up pretty well there. I'll turn this over to Kathleen in a minute to sort of speak more about it, but I'll just say, like, from my perspective, the marketing is very hard. It's very hard to distinguish yourself in a crowded field of limited attention spans, and I don't mean that in the negative way, but...
No, it's something afflicting all of us.
Yeah, people are bombarded with information all of the time, so... Cutting through the noise a little bit to say, like, hey, if you like to read, here's a great book you should check out, is very hard. It's very challenging. It's very time consuming. But I think the lessons we've learned along the way is you build a platform of quality work and you stay committed to it and you do the sort of base things that you need to do, which are sort of a website, a Facebook profile, some social media work. and you don't devote your life to it, but you keep it stocked and fed, and then you hope that readers will find it, and sometimes they do, and you hope sometimes that Hollywood will find it, and sometimes they do. But you have to do the work. You have to do the work that allows your works to be discoverable.
I think that you have to have the work. You have to have all the things in place, which, as Clark mentions, are a website and professional reviews, media reviews, as well as reader reviews. And then you hope you have all of those things in place. And then when luck strikes, when that one influencer, for lack of a better phrase, finds the book and starts just shouting about, from the rooftops about it, or whomever, the New York Times and those big media places don't really do indie books, but they're starting to. Then you wait and sit back and see what happens.
Well, one last question. As mentioned, you've published books in so many genres, and now the romance genre with Kitchen Heat and the to-be-continued Restaurant Land romance series. Any genres you have in mind that you haven't conquered yet and looking for the next series?
So many. So this will probably be news to Kathleen, but, I've always been a fancier of Conan and swords and sorcery genre. I would love to do something in that space. I don't necessarily see that as our next book. I think
that might not be a collaboration. That might be something Clark does independently.
That is a fun genre, though.
I think sort of magic is interesting and a space that we haven't explored. So I could definitely see something interesting there.
Kind of the supernatural. Beyond vampires.
Yeah, beyond vampires, like sort of witches. And, I've always found it interesting that, and this is going to sound super nerdy, but I'm going to say it anyway, America doesn't really have this tradition of magic that stretches back as far as other countries around the world, because, America was colonized and the sort of Native American magic was displaced, and it wasn't replaced with anything else because we're too young a country. So I always find that interesting.
I haven't really given that a lot of thought, I'll be honest.
For the next genre.
For the next genre.
But probably not Conan.
Maybe not Conan. We'll see. I'm not sure. It's interesting to think about.
Before we close, though, I just want to shout out Mud City Press and Deep Overstock. You introduced us, and certainly we've enjoyed reading Mud City books. They're fantastic, but we've formed a strong connection with Deep Overstock and have been at the Portland Book Festival with them two years in a row.
We share a booth, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah, we share a booth, and they're so wonderful, and their products are so great, and it's always, I'm kind of an introvert, so those festival scenarios are not always great for me, but it's always pleasant to be with them. They're just so nice, and they have great product.
Yeah, and I saw you there for the last festival in November, and you had a very good day.
Oh, it was fantastic.
A lot of book sales.
I mean, there was an hour or two there where we were just kind of, there were just people everywhere, and it was just such a terrific feeling. And people were very much responding to Kitchen Heat. And, the books were just flying off our shelves, and it was really a fun day.
Couldn't ask for a better audience.
Could not ask for a better audience.
They're readers.
They're readers, and we were as busy as in the old days in a restaurant rush. That's what it felt like. Like, just completely slammed by happy people, wanting to buy books, and it was great.
And you weren't giving out free samples of Hungarian mushrooms.
No Hungarian mushrooms. So we were giving out recipes, though.
I have the recipe. I might try that. Though I don't know if my cardiologist would approve. I don't have one, but I probably would need
it. It's rich. Let's put it that way.
It's rich. I did say that was my last question. But before we go, I heard you have some very good news, and I'd like to share that with the people listening.
We do. We have some great news, and I'm going to let Clark tell you about the book itself very briefly, but we have we were approached by a production company, and we now have entered into what's called a shopping and development agreement for the Bonnie and Clyde trilogy, and we're really excited. And yesterday, actually, we got to review a first draft screenplay for what would be a series. It was a teleplay at about 50 minutes. So, but the key part is I was skeptical that this would be the first one that we would hit with, and Clark was always sure that Bonnie and Clyde would be the first one that when Hollywood came calling.
I have believed in the Bonnie and Clyde series since we wrote it. It's my favorite of the three series. Kitchen Heat's my new favorite, but besides that. So Bonnie and Clyde's my second favorite. And you know, it's just a great storyline, and it's set in the past and in the present, the present being the 80s.
Is it based on one of the three Bonnie and Clyde books, or kind of an original
first
story?
One.
Yeah, so we were talking a little bit earlier in the show here about how important it is to create a space for someone to discover your work. And so a screenwriter who happened to see a post about Bonnie and Clyde on Facebook, checked out our website, liked what he saw, checked out our social media, listened to the interview we did with you some time ago, and decided that he wanted to give Bonnie and Clyde a pitch, basically, and write a script and have his production company shopping around Hollywood, reached out to us. And I mean, it's just like all the perfect things, as Kathleen said, you sort of build this space, and then when luck or opportunity strikes, you're ready. And that's what happened. And I'm just so passionate about the Bonnie and Clyde series. I think it really captures our social justice vibe. And we always thought it was very cinematically written. And apparently, one small part of Hollywood agrees.
I think in a previous interview on that, I read a critic say that he thought Bonnie and Clyde were kind of a low-rent Nick and Nora Charles from the Thin Man series.
That's right.
William Powell and Myrna Loy in the movies.
That's exactly right. Lots of banter and, you know, lots of hijinks. But again, as we've talked about, you know, there's this love at the center of the story, their romance, which, you know, captivated the nation at the time. But in our hands, we try to go a little bit beyond just the headlines and give them a chance at redemption. And we think if this moves forward, it's going to make a great series.
Well, Kathleen and Clark, thanks so much for sharing both your fictional romance and real life one with us today. Just in time for Valentine's Day coming up next week. And I would say a copy of Kitchen Heat, along with chocolate flowers and a big bowl of Hungarian mushroom soup, is a great way to celebrate. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so
much. Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having us on. It was so fun.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would like to hear the longer, unexpurgated version, the director's cut, you might call it if we had a director, you could listen anytime on demand at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guests today, Kathleen McFall and Clark Hayes, authors of the new novel Kitchen Heat, a restaurant land romance from Portland's Pump Jack Press. You can learn more about Kathleen and Clark, Kitchen Heat, and all their books online at pumpjackpress.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, February 22nd at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
hey, good looking, what you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me?